To reflect back on the myeloma issues covered during our CME symposium, I met with Dr. Raji, and to begin, she talked about the diagnosis, classification, and management of smoldering disease.
Smoldering multiple myeloma is a precursor disease state in multiple myeloma, and with all the advances we've had in myeloma, the obvious question is, you know, if you really want to cure the disease, then starting out early makes most sense, and trying to target a patient population who you know is going to progress to multiple myeloma may be the right place to kind of focus in on and home in on. So over the last several years, we as investigators have spent a lot of time thinking about smoldering multiple myeloma, trying to figure out what the treatment options for these patients should be. What we do know is there a subset of smoldering myeloma, and before we get into the details of it, I'm just going to define smoldering myeloma by saying that smoldering multiple myeloma is a disease situation which sort of makes all the criteria for the diagnosis of multiple myeloma without having any symptoms or any evidence of end organ damage. And I think that is critical for most of our listeners to understand. And the standard of care even today for this patient population is actually just observation. So whatever we talk about and whatever we discuss is in the space of clinical trials. What we have noted with the different staging systems in this space is this is again, a very heterogeneous patient population, so that although we can identify certain folks who are high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients, only 50% of these high-risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients will progress on to develop multiple myeloma. So if we ended up treating all patients with smoldering multiple myeloma, we would obviously be over-treating at least half of these so-called high-risk patient populations. So I think what was really interesting at this year's ASCO meeting was an effort which was an international myeloma working group effort. And what was done here was more than 1,000 patients were reviewed over the last 10, 15 years who had adequate follow-up. And these were folks who were diagnosed with smoldering multiple myeloma. And the idea here was to better risk stratify these patients and better classify them into high risk, intermediate, and low risk, and the risk being risk of progression to active symptomatic multiple myeloma. And I think what came out of this analysis, which I do think is a very useful sort of user-friendly analysis, is three risk categories, wherein you look at bone marrow plasmacytosis, you look at the total monoclonal protein, and you look at the involved versus uninvolved free light chain ratio. And the mnemonic here is 222, so again, easy to remember, 2 grams of protein, 20% plasmacytosis, and an abnormal ratio of greater than 20. And if you have all of these features, you kind of fit into a high-risk disease state. If you have one out of these three, you will fall into a low risk, and somewhere in between would be intermediate. Now, if you add on high-risk cytogenetic features, and that includes the typical translocations that we are familiar with, the 414, 1416, and the deletion 17P. If patients have any of these high-risk features, in addition to their high-risk features based on their monoclonal protein, plasmacytosis, and light chain ratio, that increases their risk, so that these folks who have the genetic high risk as well as the clinical parameters of high risk, their risk to progression goes up significantly to about 70%. And the idea of doing this was to try and apply a uniform sort of criteria to assess risk and identify who are the patients who are actually going to benefit from early intervention. So I think going forward, given that this is a fairly easy system, given that we've shown that it's very robust, we are going to test this prospectively in clinical trials and use these as criteria to define high risk. Because the problem with some of the clinical trials out there are investigators are using different criteria to identify high risk features, and it's really difficult then to compare trials across trials. So that I thought was a really important study, which was presented at this year's ASCO meeting. And I do think it's going to help us in clinical practice. And the bottom line for most of our listeners should be that if you do have high risk disease, consider a clinical trial for sure. And if not a clinical trial, follow these patients very closely, because these are the ones who are ultimately going to progress to multiple myeloma.
One other topic that sort of comes in before I ask you about treatment is imaging, particularly bone imaging. In what situations do you advise it, and what type of bone imaging?
So again, a very important question, Neil, and I just want to backtrack a little bit here, because I think it was about 4 years back now where we redefined the criteria for symptomatic multiple myeloma. And in that IMWG guideline, we actually mentioned the use of imaging outside of skeletal surveys. So most of us have moved away from typical x-rays, and what we will typically do is either a low-dose CAT scan or a PET CT scan or an MRI. So every smoldering multiple myeloma patient, before you say that they don't have bone disease, should have had one of these imaging modalities. And if they haven't had any evidence of bone disease, then you can truly call them smoldering multiple myeloma. If, on the other hand, they have evidence of any kind of focal lesion based on these more specific and, you know, better imaging modalities, those are the ones you would then consider for active treatment with myeloma. As far as smoldering myeloma is concerned, you know, at the time of diagnosis, we will recommend one of these imaging modalities. And then over time, there are no clear guidelines, but at least once a year, if you have a high suspicion of them progressing on to multiple myeloma, you should use one of these more sensitive imaging techniques to monitor their disease.
So what about treatment? We saw another data set presented at ASCO. Can you talk about that? And in general, what we know about treatment right now?
So as of right now, as far as treatment for smoldering multiple myeloma is concerned, it should be no treatment at all. It is watchful waiting, and that is essentially still in 2019 should be the guidance for most oncologists. As I mentioned earlier, we are doing a lot of work in this space, a lot of research being done in this space. And if you go on to clinicaltrials.gov, you're going to see a lot of different clinical trials addressing this whole smoldering multiple myeloma population. So I would certainly recommend a clinical trial if that makes sense for that particular patient. What was presented at this year's ASCO and then EHA meeting was the ECOG trial. And the ECOG trial compared the use of lenalidomide in intermediate risk and high risk smoldering multiple myeloma patients to no treatment at all. And what they found here was if you had lenalidomide as treatment, which was 25 milligrams of lenalidomide, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, and the idea was to continue this lenalidomide up until progression, what was noted was that patients who got the treatment with lenalidomide actually had an improvement in their progression-free survival. Now, we do not as yet have data on overall survival, and in my mind at least, for a smoldering multiple myeloma patient population, before we adopt this as clinical practice, we do need to see some improvement in overall survival, and we are obviously going to have to wait a long time for this. So as of right now, at least the data suggests that the progression-free survival improves. We did see some toxicities in patients who are getting lenalidomide treatment. We saw a slight increase in second cancers in this otherwise asymptomatic patient population. And we also saw that most patients were able to continue treatment for approximately a year, and then they stopped treatment because of toxicities from the treatment itself. So treating patients with smoldering myeloma is not a trivial decision, and even today should be done only in the context of a clinical trial.
So let's go on now and talk a little bit about upfront therapy of myeloma. We chatted about that with Paul Richardson, the other faculty person there, and brought up a couple of issues. And one particular pressing issue is the issue of what's the standard of care nowadays. It has been RVD for a long time. We're starting to see some really interesting results coming out with daratumumab. Where are we today, and where do you think we might be in the next couple of years in terms of induction therapy?
So I think as far as induction treatment is concerned, most of us have adopted the use of a triplet regimen. And in the transplant eligible patient, we're using generally a proteasome inhibitor with an IMID and a steroid. So RBD or KRD has sort of been adopted as the treatment in the transplant eligible patient population. What you saw very nicely covered at this year's ASCO and later on at EHA as well is now quadruplet regimens. So for the first time we heard from the Cassiopeia trialists a quadruplet regimen of VTD, that's bortezomib, thalidomide, dexamethasone, in combination with daratumumab. So those monoclonal antibodies, which we used to use in the relapse refractory setting, are certainly coming up front. And when you look at this data, we saw very high overall response rates and obviously a much better progression-free survival, as well as maybe a hint towards a survival advantage of the quadruplet when compared to the triplet. So I do believe that the future is going to be quadruplets. We just don't have the data just as yet in the transplant eligible to transition everybody to the quadruplet. I do think one has to take into account as you add more drugs, you're going to see more toxicity as well. And once you start seeing that, the question becomes, you know, to try and get to that MRD negative state, how much are you able to forego in terms of toxicity? And it ultimately will have to be a balance of efficacy versus toxicity. As far as the non-transplant eligible patient population is concerned, I do think we have a new standard of care, and the new standard of care is triplets. Up until recently, we were using the doublet of lenalidomide and dexamethasone, so RD, based on the first trial, was considered sort of the standard of care. With the Maya trial now, we have DRD, or Dara, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and that is really going to be a game changer, because if you look at the PFS of patients getting the antibody with the lenalidomide and dexamethasone at about close to 2.5 to 3 years, we have more than 70% of people remaining progression-free. So that's really good data, and I don't think we've seen better data than this combination of monoclonal antibody with RD. Traditionally, we've been using triplets in this patient population as well. As you know, we've adopted using RVD in a modified fashion, which we like referring to as RVD light. And that's, again, been a very successful approach in this transplant-eligible patients. So as we move forward and as we get more comfortable, I do think we're going to use more and more in terms of combination strategies. The question is going to be, you know, up until recently, we've always talked about continuous therapy or continuing treatment up until progression. When we start seeing these triplets and quadruplets with really high quality responses, can we then begin to ask the question of, okay, can I stop the treatment in a subset of patients? We're not quite there as yet, but I do think that's going to be a question which is going to be asked in some of our future clinical trials.
So you've been a very vocal proponent of what you called RVD light for a while, but I'm just kind of curious right now, are you tempted to try the RDD? Have you tried that regimen? I don't even know if you can give it. And if you do that, would you want to slip in a little proteasome inhibitor and make it RVD light, Dara?
Yes. So those are all great questions. And I've certainly used RD-DERA because I was an investigator on the Maya trial. And, you know, patients are able to tolerate it. Once they get their first one or two doses of daratumumab, in general, most patients do well with the monoclonal antibody. And we've seen excellent results with that. You're talking about a quadruplet, and I agree with you 100%. You know, we shouldn't be focused on quadruplets only in the younger patient population. I do think the older patient population also deserve just as good a remission as the younger patient population. And we, in fact, have designed a trial of sneaking in the proteasome inhibitor in a quadruplet combination. And what we will be doing through the Alliance very soon is a clinical trial, which is including IRD, so ixazomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone with daratumumab. And this is where, you know, we are using MRD as an endpoint, and based on that MRD endpoint, we are actually modifying the maintenance part of the treatment to one drug versus two drugs and seeing whether we can get away by doing less and doing stipulated course of therapy for these patients.
You know, it's interesting. I was just in an interview related to the topic of CLL and their MRD and same issue, trying to make shorter term therapy, particularly in the MRD negative patient. We talked with Paul and you about this issue of MRD in general, but also I brought up the question, and we actually asked the audience about it, whether or not it should be considered in patients in the decision for immediate versus delayed transplant. Right now, obviously, MRD is a huge issue in trials, but what about outside a trial setting?
So I would hesitate to use it outside of a clinical trial because, you know, none of the studies which we've shown in the context of MRD have as yet shown us that we can actually tailor therapy based on your MRD result. I think what we've shown to date is MRD is a good surrogate in terms of response. If you are MRD negative, you do much better, and you can almost use that as a surrogate for PFS as well as overall survival. So from a regulatory endpoint, we needed this to be FDA approved so that especially when you start using 3 and 4 drug combinations, we see extremely high response rates. And, you know, the majority of patients, close to 100% of our patients are responding to the combination treatments that we are using. Then how does one discriminate one combination versus another, which is where MRD comes in. The other important piece with MRD, given that we've shown that it translates very nicely with PFS as well as overall survival, you don't have to wait for that overall survival benefit, but you can use this as a surrogate to come up with clinical decision making and come up with regulatory approvals much, much faster. So as of right now, I do look at MRD testing as a regulatory tool. The next generation of clinical trials that we have designed have actually asked that exact same question that you are asking, wherein we are using MRD as a tool to either escalate or de-escalate treatment. And when we do that, and when we have the data to speak to that, that's when I think we should be in a position to start using MRD in clinical practice.
But you know, I brought up, and you know, again, maybe just more from you know, sort of a naive point of view, but I brought up the IFM trial, and to me, you know, it looked like MRD maybe would have a role there in terms of deciding whether, you know, delaying transplant would be an option. But both you and Paul pushed back on that in the meeting. Can you talk a little bit more about your thoughts about why it wasn't relevant in those data?
So I do think it's relevant, but in a, I think it's important for us to understand the context of that information. You know, MRD testing there was sort of done retrospectively, and the time for decision-making for transplant is around after four cycles or 3 cycles in the IFM study. This MRD testing was done at the end of a year, and that's not the time you make a decision for transplant versus no transplant. Going forward, I think this data gives us confidence in showing us that if you're MRD negative at the end of a year, whether you got just RVD or you got RVD with or without the transplant, your outcome is going to be quite similar. But until we have that kind of information, I don't think we can jump to the fact that, yes, we can stop doing or base our decision on MRD testing, which was done at a much later time point. So that's where the struggle is right now. I think going forward, again, you know, we'll have to look at MRD testing at maybe 4 months and seeing if you're MRD negative at that point in time, do you randomize patients to transplant versus no transplant? And then can you come up with a surrogate there? But until we have that information, I would be careful with interpreting some of that data.
Another issue that we talked about in terms of induction was the issue of carfilzomib. And we did see more data on that. And obviously the ECOG trials out there comparing KRD to RVD. Where are we right now in terms of that issue?
So, you know, the ECOG trial did include KRD and it compared it to essentially KCD, and there was no RVD in that Forte trial. And what it showed us very nicely is that the IMiD proteasome inhibitor containing combination is way better than the Cytoxan containing regimen. So most of us would agree that in a transplant eligible patient, you need to have an IMiD, you need to have a proteasome inhibitor and the steroid. I think the bigger question in the Forte trial was KRD with transplant and KRD without transplant. And I think for the first time, we saw really robust data at the end of a year showing us wherein MRD negativity with or without a transplant was not very different, suggesting that just the triplet drug combination can get you to an MRD negative state. What was shown also by the investigators at this year's ASCO meeting, which was an advance to what was presented by them at ASH last year, was the fact that there's a subset of a patient population, and that's mainly speaking to the high-risk patient population. And when you look at this high-risk patient population, this may be a patient population wherein actually that transplant did make a difference, so that getting a transplant seemed to portend a better outcome for folks with the, they included patients with 414 and 1416. They did not have the deletion 17P included in the subset of patients. You know, I'm going to push back a little bit over there, because what they did do in this trial at the end of a year was a second randomization. And their second randomization is to using lenalidomide versus lenalidomide plus the carfilzomib. So proteasome inhibitor plus lenalidomide versus lenalidomide. And I don't think at that randomization, they actually took care of high risk versus low risk, or at least they haven't shown us that data. And in my mind, or at least the data we have, you know, most of us would agree that if you have some of those high risk features, which they have alluded to in this clinical trial, the majority of us would use a doublet. We would not use just lenalidomide maintenance. So although based on the Forte trials data, at least as of right now, the suggestion is that the high-risk patient population does benefit from the transplant. I think once you take into account this, you know, second randomization to dual maintenance versus single maintenance, I'm not so sure that it's going to pan out that the high-risk patients actually need that transplant. So I think we just have to wait a little bit longer, but certainly the high-risk ones were the ones who were progressing more and seemed to need the more aggressive sort of treatment.
In terms of KRD versus RVD, any speculations on maybe, I'm not going to ask you to predict, but do you have the thought that maybe carfilzomib induces a deeper response, more MRD? Do you think it's more efficacious?
So it's tough to say. And, you know, there is a trial which is ongoing in the ECOG trial, which has compared RVD to KRD. Whether or not we get any data out of this is going to be difficult. It was supposed to be a transplant deferred sort of trial. Having said that, a lot of patients ended up getting the transplant and they ended up getting just the initial induction with the KRD and RVD. You know, if we are able to look at depth of response with MRD negativity, we might see a benefit of one versus the other. And, you know, if you think about proteasome inhibitors in general, I do think we all would agree that carfilzomib is probably one of the most potent proteasome inhibitor. Then it's bortezomib and next is ixazomib in terms of just its potency. But once you take into account potency, I think it has to be balanced with toxicity as well. And as long as potency and toxicity are sort of equal, then you can pick one or the other. But long-term outcomes of RVD versus KRD, we'll have to wait and see. The feeling is that KRD certainly is more potent compared to RVD.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see, though, the toxicity comparison. I'm particularly curious about what they see, and I mentioned this at the meeting, because ever since carfilzomib has come out, there's been this issue of cardiorespiratory things, as dyspnea that some patients get. It hasn't really clear to me at all what's going on. I'm curious what your thoughts are nowadays about that phenomena. Do you see that with bortezomib?
So we don't see that so much with bortezomib. Bortezomib, actually, given that we're doing it once a week and giving it subcutaneously, you know, it's extremely well tolerated. We do end up, I think the most significant dose-limiting toxicity of bortezomib is the neuropathy, which really doesn't come on until you've used bortezomib quite a bit. Carfilzomib, on the other hand, we do see this immediate sort of cardiopulmonary symptoms. You do see issues around fluid overload. A lot of this can be mitigated, though, if you, you know, watch the amount of fluid you're giving and give the drug a little more slowly. But there are patients who will have issues around respiratory distress, hold on to fluid, swelling, and so on and so forth. I think it's, you know, we've learned how to give these drugs now. And once we are able to manage their toxicities, patients are able to tolerate them quite well. Also, I think it's to do with the dosing and how often you give the carfilzomib. So there is a lot of data which is coming out now on the weekly dosing of carfilzomib. We're going to much higher doses and we've increased the infusion times of the carfilzomib. So I do think over time we will understand how best to use these drugs and mitigate some of the toxicities associated with them.
We talked a little bit also about the issue of maintenance therapy after transplant, and you were alluding to the issue of using proteasome inhibitors in patients with high-risk disease. And one of the things we talked about was the use of ixazomib as maintenance therapy, an oral longer-term therapy seeming to be very advantageous. What are the situations right now where you're using ixazomib, and how do you find it tolerated, particularly in terms of GI issues?
Ixazomib being oral, being a weekly treatment, is actually an ideal drug for sort of maintenance treatment for myeloma. And, you know, there is the Tourmaline trial which looked at maintenance ixazomib, compared it to no treatment. And although the data is not overtly impressive, you know, it did show a benefit in terms of a progression-free survival advantage. The place where I would think of using ixazomib most is when I'm using bortezomib, for example, and my patient is unable to tolerate bortezomib for whatever reason, whether it's neuropathy, etc. I would have a very low threshold to switch to ixazomib. In general, I've had patients stay on ixazomib for years. It's extremely well tolerated. You did bring up the issue of GI toxicity. We occasionally will see GI toxicity in these patients, but in general, quite easy to manage this because it's a once a week dosing schedule. The other place where I do think I would consider using ixazomib for sure is, you know, there is a subset of patients where I will use dual maintenance, and it's what I alluded to earlier on, is this high-risk patient population, which is the 414, 1416, and deletion 17P patients who need the proteasome inhibitor in addition to the lenalidomide. And when they are on this dual maintenance, if they can do an oral drug with the IMID, that would be the preferred way of using this in this high-risk patient population.
In terms of the standard risk patient, are there any patients who can avoid having to take lenalidomide maintenance, or in your hands, do all of them receive it?
I think that's a great question. And this is where I do think using testing like MRD in future clinical trials is going to help us identify who are the ones who don't need to be on anything. I think what we have learned from the IFM data set is you need to be on at least 1 year of therapy, maybe 2 years of therapy. And then if we can show, like how our CML colleagues have already shown us, is you're MRD negative at year one, you're MRD negative at 6 months after, or maybe a year after, and then consider stopping treatment. We've still not done that, and the teaching right now is lenalidomide up until progression. But using this MRD tool to de-escalate in a subset of patients, I think is going to be critical, because here's where, you know, giving these drugs does not come without toxicity. You do have to deal with second cancers, neutropenias, chronic diarrhea in certain situations. And if we can identify who are the patients who don't need to be in these drugs, is just as important as who are the ones who are actually going to do well with these drugs.
And actually, we were talking about the issues of keeping people on long-term lenalidomide. I was sharing with you, actually, right after that, we were talking about R-squared in follicular lymphoma, which involves longer-term use of lenalidomide, and lymphoma people kind of saying, oh, lenalidomide is a tough drug to give long-term, and we were saying, well, you know, the myeloma people use it all the time. Any sort of pearls of wisdom about how to keep patients successfully on lenalidomide long term?
I think that one of this is the mindset also. I think lymphomas have the mindset of chemotherapy for a stipulated time frame, and then you're done and you move on. With myeloma, we've always talked about continuous therapy, so we've sort of accepted that as a norm. I think what we are beginning to see, though, Neil, is given that we're seeing so many combinations come up, given that we're seeing really high-quality responses, we can begin to ask, when do we stop treatment as well, which is going to be a very legitimate question from a quality of life sort of profile for patients. Because although we say, take the drug forever, you know, ask a patient who's on lenalidomide, they don't feel 100%, and that's for sure. As far as how best can you keep people on drug for as long as you can, I think recognizing toxicities and mitigating those toxicities as best as you can by dose reducing, dose interruptions, and so on and so forth are absolutely critically important. Lenalidomide, for example, you know, one of the chronic toxicities associated with lenalidomide is diarrhea. And most often using drugs like Imodium work, but there are certain other situations like lenalidomide, you tend to become lactose intolerant. So staying away from dairy is a good idea. Using drugs like cholestipol, which allows you to tolerate fatty foods better, actually makes a huge difference in the lives of patients.
When you're giving maintenance lenalidomide, is there a dose that's so low that it's just not worth giving?
So I have gone all the way down to 5 milligrams of lenalidomide also. I don't go below 5, but I've done kind of, you know, when they're on 5 milligrams, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. There are some patients who even that is too much, and I've done 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Beyond that, I have not gone any lower because, you know, that would probably be me treating myself. It'd be a homeopathic dose. But in general, you know, when you see patients on these drugs like the IMIDs going from 5 to 25, I don't think this is chemotherapy, which necessarily has a dose response. And that brings me to another one of your favorite questions of what do you consider as len refractory? Do you go up to 25 milligrams of len after 10? Well, I, you know, even if I do, that response doesn't last too long. It lasts a couple months and that's it. So in my mind, whatever dose of lenalidomide they were on, if they progress on that, they become refractory. But again, because of this lack of dose response, you know, you have the ability to go up and down depending on the ability of the patient to tolerate this.
So yeah, one of the things we talked about was the management of the patient who relapses on maintenance lenalidomide, a very common situation. And you and Paul went through a lot of different alternatives, including what you were talking about just now, the possibility increasing the dose, adding in elotuzumab, and then the whole spectrum of other options. Can you go through the various options that you consider in a patient who is developing relapse on maintenance lenalidomide?
So I think, you know, this is a really important area, important space, and we don't have a lot of clinical trials in this space except for some of those which have gotten approved over the last year or so. So a len refractory patient population was not included in all the previous approvals of the Castors and the Poluxes and so on and so forth. They were all patients who were getting RD as their control arm. I think the next generation of studies, which has included the combination of pomalidomide, these are the ones which are more relevant to this len refractory patient population. And depending on how patients actually progress while on lenalidomide, you know, you had data which was presented by Paul at this year's ASCO meeting, the Icaria study of Palm-Dex with or without isatuximab, which is another CD38 monoclonal antibody. And if you look at the data set, more than 75% of these patients were lenalidomide refractory. So really speaking to this patient population of len refractory patients. Last year's ASCO, we had the Optimism trial presented, and that was pomalidomide with bortezomib and dex. And again, in that patient population, about 70% of them were at least len exposed and len refractory. So considering the use of a pom-dex backbone, and to that backbone, either consider adding a CD38 monoclonal antibody or consider adding a proteasome inhibitor like bortezomib or carfilzomib, bortezomib, we have data to speak to both of those. We have other data as well with drugs like the CD38 monoclonal antibodies, with drugs like proteasome inhibitors, so carfilzomib, for example, would be perfectly reasonable. And again, I think the decision as to what your partner drug should be with pomalidomide would really depend on the nature of the relapse. How aggressive is the relapse? Is this a biochemical relapse, or is this fulminant clinical relapse? And then one can pick and choose between some of these combinations that we've just talked about.
Getting back to anti-CD38, there was some more data presented on subcutaneous daratumumab at ASCO. Where are we with that? It seems like a very, patient-friendly strategy.
I think the data which was presented by Dr. Mateos at this year's ASCO was actually excellent data. This was a randomized trial comparing intravenous daratumumab to the subcutaneous version. The neat thing about this was the subcutaneous version was easy to give. It took 5 minutes. It was extremely well tolerated. The infusion-related reactions were significantly lower in the subcutaneous version of the CD38 monoclonal antibody. And really, it will be a practice-changing move for multiple myeloma, and it'll be easy to combine with some of the other approaches so that patients don't have to wait and do those 6 to 8 hours of infusion times. So I do think it's going to be a game changer. A little bit of a word of caution here, though. If you look at this, this was single-agent data. We will need to gather a little bit of data with combination approaches, specifically with the IMiDs, because although infusion-related reactions, etc., were much, much lower in the subcutaneous version. When you look at things like myelotoxicity, just because of the pharmacokinetics of these drugs, wherein a subcutaneous version is going to hang around the system for a little bit longer, you might see more neutropenia, more thrombocytopenia. So when you start combining them with, say, lenalidomide and pomalidomide, we'll have to do a little bit of homework before we know what the ideal doses are.
So you mentioned this drug, isatuximab, another anti-CD38. Could you kind of talk a little bit about what that is and what other anti-CD38s are out there and how they compare to daratumumab?
So isatuximab was the data which was presented. This was the Icaria study. It was isatuximab with Pom-Dex, and it is the only phase 3 randomized trial with a Pom-based CD38 monoclonal antibody combination. Now, I don't know if it matters too much in the United States because we already have daratumumab and pomalidomide approved just based on phase 2 data, but having this phase 3 data is really important, especially from the European regulatory standpoint. Is there a difference between daratumumab versus isatuximab? I don't know. Theoretically, there is some hint at suggesting that isatuximab actually inhibits the enzymatic activity of CD38. In general, I think both of them work pretty similar to each other. As far as toxicities are concerned, the other sort of takeaway here was that isatuximab is slightly better tolerated. The infusion-related reactions are a little bit less, and you can actually give it over 4 hours. But, we've come a long way with daratumumab. We now have 90-minute infusions with dara, and you just heard data with subcutaneous daratumumab, wherein you don't have infusion-related reactions. So in general, I'm going to say that it doesn't matter which CD38 monoclonal antibody you use. As far as efficacy is concerned, they seem to me to be fairly comparable. And obviously, once the subcutaneous version comes along, if it's just as well tolerated, which it appears to be, that's the one which is going to be adopted in practice because of convenience.
So I want to ask you about a couple other sort of the new/evolving strategies in myeloma, one being an agent that Paul presented on, melflufen. What is that and where do you think it's heading?
So melflufen is another alkylating agent, and it's supposed to be better bioavailable, and it's supposed to be better tolerated because of the way the structure is created. So alkylating agents in general have always been a part of sort of salvage strategies for myeloma. We've used a lot of Cytoxan in myeloma. We've ended up using a lot of melflufen in myeloma, and this would be an additional melflufen which is sort of better tolerated and would be able to combine quite easily with less of the mucositis seen with the high-dose melphalan that we are typically used to seeing. So I do think it's going to be used maybe in the relapse refractory setting, maybe as sort of bridging treatment to something else, and we'll have to wait on the data for that, but it is going to be used in combination with other agents in this space.
Am I correct in saying it's approved?
It's not yet approved.
It's not yet approved. If it were approved, how would you use it?
You know, I would consider using it wherever I'm considering using Cytoxan, for example. I think one of the caveats here is you want to make sure, you know, with melphalan, the worry is that this is going to be stem cell toxic. So if you're using bendamustine, for example, for myeloma, which I don't use a whole lot of, I would consider using melflu. Outside of that, you know, combination more as a salvage strategy with either a proteasome inhibitor or an IMiD would be what I would consider doing.
So let's talk a little bit about venetoclax in myeloma. It's been kind of an interesting story that's evolved over the recent months, so to speak. Can you comment a little bit on what we know about venetoclax?
Venetoclax, as you know, is a BCL-2 inhibitor, and this BCL-2 inhibitor is obviously approved in the lymphomas in CLL, and patients are doing quite well with that. What we did was early studies, and this was phase 1 and phase 2 studies, demonstrated efficacy in myeloma and specifically in patients with the 1114 translocation. And the thought here is that folks who have the 1114 translocation preferentially are dependent on the BCL2 pathway in terms of its apoptotic signaling machinery. And at least the phase 2 data with venetoclax as well as venetoclax in combination with either carfilzomib or bortezomib has shown really quite remarkable results. The Bellini trial was presented at this year's EHA as a late breaker, and this was a trial which was supposed to be the definitive trial of combining venetoclax with bortezomib and dexamethasone. And what they did here was used all comers. So they did not focus on 1114 translocated patients, but they took everybody. And what was noted here was when you use the triplet, that is when you use venetoclax in combination with bortezomib and dex, your response rate was higher and it translated into an improved progression-free survival. But unfortunately, it also translated into a disadvantage when it came to overall survival. Having said that, I do think they're going to look at subgroups and look at 1114 translocated patients, and we'll have to wait and see if you see that survival disadvantage there. My understanding is that the survival disadvantage was seen because of increased neutropenia, increased infections, and the question really is, did we need to go up to the 800 milligrams of dose of venetoclax, which was used in this clinical trial, in the Bellini trial, or can we get away with less? And I think all of those questions are going to come to the forefront, because I do think venetoclax is useful in a subset of patients where everything else has failed.
So at this point, if you had a patient with 1114 who had run out of options, although I don't know if that's even possible anymore nowadays, would you attempt to use venetoclax?
I would, and I have. I think it's a question of dosing, Neil, and I don't think one has to go aggressively all the way up to 800, anywhere between 400 and 600 milligrams, especially when you're using it in combination, seems to work. In folks who have the isolated 1114 translocation, it actually does work quite well.
Yeah, I was kind of fantasizing. I've heard people hypothesize what would have happened if you gave trastuzumab to everybody with breast cancer and not just the 20% who was HER2 positive. And, you know, maybe that's kind of like what's going on here. You have toxicity from the majority of the patients, but it's only a minority. What fraction of myeloma is 1114?
It's about 15% of them who are 1114 translocated.
So maybe they're kind of getting diluted out. Is that what you think's going on here?
Absolutely. I think, and you know, this is a test which we routinely do on FISH testing. So I do think doing a more intelligent trial focusing on the 11, and this would be the first biomarker sort of driven trial, would be better than using this drug in all comers, specifically when we have, you know, the myeloma space is fairly crowded to begin with. So this may be one of those niche drugs.
So let's finish out talking about CAR-T and related strategies. Can you kind of update us on where we are today?
So, you know, a lot of excitement around CAR T cells, obviously a lot of hype around CAR T cells. We saw data, which is now published data of the first sort of phase one trial with close to a little over 30 patients there with long-term follow-up. And we've seen it translate into a PFS of about 12 months. Now, these were very refractory patients to anything and everything they had seen before. So for us to even see that CAR T cells works in this patient population was, in my mind, quite remarkable. The other reassuring thing with all of our CAR T cell studies was it's actually a very well-tolerated procedure in terms of CRS and neurotoxicity. We didn't see really terrible neurotoxicity, in fact, very little neurotoxicity, and most of the CRS we saw was, you know, easy to manage. I don't want to trivialize the treatment because it does require to be done in a specialized center. It does require some, you know, people need to understand the toxicities. Having said that, though, we quite easily can give CAR T cells to patients well into their 70s without a lot of problems. I think part of the issue with CAR T cells is, since it's still in the context of clinical trials, access to CAR T cells is still limited. It takes 3 to 4 weeks for us to create those CAR T cells, and sometimes patients just don't have the time to wait for those 3 and 4 weeks to get those CAR products. So I think the bigger issue right now is access to CAR T cells and availability and generation of these CAR T cells. As we open up more clinical trials, hopefully that'll be less of a problem. Having said this, you know, we have a lot of other sort of approaches in this space, and this is all directed against the same target, which is BCMA. So the B-cell maturation antigen, which has been proven to be a great target in multiple myeloma because it's sort of ubiquitously present on all tumor cells. You know, you have two other approaches, one of them using a conjugated antibody. The DREAM studies have been now presented and published. And as a single agent with a conjugated off-the-shelf antibody, we're seeing a response rate of 60%. And you're seeing a PFS of close to 1 year. And that's quite remarkable. I will say that these were less heavily pretreated. If you look at patients who were truly dara refractory, their PFS was about 6 months. But nonetheless, as a single agent off-the-shelf treatment, the response rates have been very robust. And I just want to go back to, you know, when we were using monoclonal antibodies for the first time, for example, daratumumab. When you look at single agent daratumumab and the response rate with single agent daratumumab, it was close to 30%. With this, the overall response rate is 60%, so doubling over what we've seen with CD38 directed treatments. So in the future, when you start combining these drugs, I think you're going to get very robust responses and you're going to see remission durations which are going to increase quite significantly. I think a word of caution with the conjugated antibody is the ocular toxicity, which everybody is talking about. So there are patients who had significant ocular toxicity wherein required dose interruptions as well as dose reductions and stopping of treatment. So we'll have to wait and see what that ocular toxicity is all about. So that's the only sort of cautionary note on this conjugated antibody. Otherwise, I think it's a very exciting area. The other part which has been very exciting, and it's the BiTE antibodies. And BiTE antibodies are the bispecific T-cell engagers. And what they do is essentially what CAR T-cells do, but they do it without the hassle of actually having to produce these products or taking out your cells, genetically modifying them, and then giving it back to patients. BiTEs are off-the-shelf antibodies which have the linker arm to the CD3 to activate your T cells, and then the other linker arm goes and targets the tumor cell. In this case, it's BCMA again. I think you saw data at this year's ASCO as well as at last year's ASH with AMG-420. This is a short-acting BiTE, and at the recommended phase 2 dose, which was, I believe, for 480 milligrams of the BiTE antibody, we saw, you know, there were 10 or 12 patients, but 5 or 6 of them actually achieved an MRD negative state. So again, to use an off-the-shelf antibody and get MRD negative disease is remarkable. A couple of things to think about with the BiTE antibody. antibodies is, this specifically is a short-acting antibody, so it's a continuous infusion, and we are continuing this infusion indefinitely in patients as of right now. So how feasible would that be in the future, or should this be considered as a bridge to something else, would be the more logical question to ask. You know, we have seen toxicities which are not completely explained in this patient population, and the two which came top of my mind were infections, and these were not kind of typical infections that we are seeing. This was like invasive fungal infection and adenoviral infection, so reactivation of some kind of viruses is always a problem with some of these T-cell directed treatments, so I think we need to watch out for that. And then another very interesting phenomenon which was seen with this BCMA bite was this polyneuropathy-like phenomenon. And I don't think, you know, patients did get better from it, but we don't have a clear understanding of why that was happening. So I think a lot of exciting things in this space, but all of them sort of early in their development. And in my mind, we're just about beginning to learn about where they fit into the paradigm of treating multiple myeloma.
What about the issue of cytokine release and neurologic complications of CAR T? Can you talk about what's been seen with the BCMA agents or therapies?
So the ones we've used with the BCMA bites, and I'll talk specifically about the BB2121 and the 21217 products. And I think it's important to recognize that both of these products have the same co-stimulatory domain. So they're using 4-1BB to cause activation of your T cells. Now, the majority of CARs which are being used in the multiple myeloma space are using 4-1BB. There were a few others who'd use CD28. So with 4-1BB, the thought is that your T cells expand a little more slowly and the kinetics of the expansion is a little bit different. You know, fortunately for us in the BB2121 studies, at least, we have really not seen maybe one grade 4 neurotoxicity, and we've treated more than 150, close to 200 patients now. We haven't seen any neurotoxicity. Grade 1 and 2, sure, we see significant amounts of that, but that is easy to manage. So in general, I think the neurotoxicity signal has been very low, and whatever neurotoxicity we've seen has been very manageable in the multiple myeloma protocols. As far as CRS is concerned, which is a cytokine release syndrome, you know, we see CRS in the majority of patients, but again, the majority of CRS seen in this BB2121 trials was 70% of them had grade 1 and 2 CRS. So grade 3 and 4, which is the real significant sort of requiring ICU level care, requiring tocilizumab, was seen in a minority of patients. And if you look at our phase 1 trial, I believe it was only 7 or 8 patients who actually received tocilizumab, which is the IL-6 receptor antibody, which mitigates CRS. So again, in my mind, concern going into CAR T cells for multiple myeloma was obviously toxicity, but coming out of it on the other end, you know, we've been pleasantly surprised and reassured by the fact that we are seeing very manageable toxicity with these products.
The other issue is efficacy, and, you know, it's kind of hard for us on the outside as we're hearing these things, or at least for me, to sort of distill it down, but it kind of sounds like maybe the efficacy, the enthusiasm about it maybe has diminished a little bit. Am I kind of reading that right?
I think it's a question of expectations, to be honest. You know, I think when you think about CAR T cells, you're thinking about a curative platform. And we are comparing it to what you see with leukemia and sometimes with the lymphomas as well. And I do think biology plays a big part here. We are treating a very different disease. You know, up until even today, we talk about using continuous therapy for myeloma. We talk about using maintenance treatment for myeloma. And the fact that we've shown that CAR T cells actually works, that you get MRD negative disease, which lasts for close to a year in a patient population which did not have a lot of options, really tells me that, you have a very active modality of treatment, and it is the beginning of us trying to understand where to place this treatment. You cannot expect to cure people end-stage myeloma. So can we think about moving it forward, given that we've shown that toxicity does not seem to be such a big issue? And are there other things that we can think about doing to try and make sure that these CAR T cells persist and continue to grow and continue to remain active in patients? So these are all areas of research, and we are, you know, already accruing to phase 2 and phase 3 trials. Phase 2, for example, we are focusing on a high-risk patient population. So high-risk, by definition, anybody who relapses within 18 months of their initial treatment would be considered high-risk with the high-risk features, so that we're trying to offer this modality of treatment early on in disease state and seeing whether or not it makes a difference. And obviously, from a lab standpoint, we're looking at a whole bunch of things. End-stage myeloma, you're not going to have the fittest T cells. And if your T cells are not fit, we do understand that your response to a T cell-directed therapy is just going to be that much lower. So does fitness of the T cell matter? Does timing of the T cell platform matter? And my sense is that the answer to all of this is going to be yes. And it is for us to try and understand where to best use these modalities.
Anything that we haven't talked about today that you want to bring up that maybe we brought up in the seminar, or just things that you bring up when you talk to general medical oncologists?
You know, I think the good news is there's a lot and lot of options for multiple myeloma. And I do think every year we tend to do better. And that is reflected by the fact that patients are surviving that much longer. Given that we have trials in every sort of disease state, my recommendation to most community oncologists is, you know, try and partner with somebody at an academic site. Try and work with that so that your patients have access and option to clinical trials, as well as you have the option to expertise, because things are evolving so, so rapidly, and it's almost impossible keeping up with the data set. And to me, I think the most important thing is making sure that our patients have the knowledge and have the access to some of these new, incredibly active drugs. And as long as we can get them to them early. So, you know, for example, CAR T cells, don't wait for them to have their 9th relapse and then send them to you for CAR T cells. Send them to us early, because you know that wait lists are long, and the sooner we get them into the system, the chances of them having access to these options are that much higher.
Subsequent to my interview with Dr. Raji on June 27th, the FDA approved daratumumab in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone for patients with newly diagnosed myeloma who are ineligible for stem cell transplant. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special follow-up interview program to a satellite CME symposium held during the annual ASCO meeting.